Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Assisi, I love your rolling fields, your flowers.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. As a Franciscan, I'm excited that the Pope is traveling to Assisi. He will be celebrating Mass at the Basilica of San Francesco, where St. Francis and his early companions are buried, in the Cathedral of San Rufino, where Saints Francis and Claire were baptized. The Holy Father will meet with Franciscan clergy and religious. His day will finish with an encounter with youth in the Basilica of St. Mary of the Angels, seen by all Franciscans as their spiritual home. This year, Franciscans around the world are celebrating the occasion when, 800 years ago, Francis started on a spiritual journey towards his dream of complete unity with the poor and crucified Christ. In today's program, we take a look at the start of Francis's journey with two renowned Franciscans, Fathers Murray Bodo and Bill Short. Just as St. Francis had an enduring love for the whole of creation, we will also hear from a chaplain to the Royal Air Force who is reaching for the sky in a different way. But first, we will hear the Pope's message from today's general audience. Chris Altieri has more.
Cari fratelli e sorelle, nella storia del cristianesimo antico è fondamentale la distinzione fra i primi tre secoli e quelli.
Pope Benedict XVI began his catechesis by saying there is a fundamental distinction between the first three centuries of the life of the Church and those that came after the Council of Nicaea, the first ecumenical council. Pope Benedict reflected on the life, thought, and contribution of the early theologian and historian Eusebius of Caesarea.
Eusebius is best known for his ecclesiastical history, which documented the first centuries of the Church's life and preserved much precious evidence which would otherwise be lost. His Christocentric approach to history emphasized the gradual revelation of God's merciful love for humanity, culminating in the coming of Christ, the spread of the gospel, and the growth of the Church. Eusebius' writings continue to inspire Christians in every age to let their study of history bear fruit in a greater appreciation of God's saving works, a deeper conversion to Christ, and a more generous witness to the gospel in everyday life.
Speaking in Italian, Pope Benedict also expressed his best wishes for students and school children who, in many parts of the world these days, are finishing their exams and entering the months of summer rest and relaxation.
Vi aiuti il Signore a vivere questo periodo con serenità e a sperimentare la sua protezione.
At the end of the audience, Pope Benedict saluted the faithful in many languages, including English.
I welcome the participants in the leadership course organized by the International Catholic Charismatic Renewal Services. My greetings also go to the Buddhist members of Risho Kosei Kai and the representatives of the Apostolate for Family Consecration. Upon all the English-speaking visitors present to this audience, especially those from England, Nigeria, Japan, and the United States, I invoke God's abundant blessings.
In July, the Holy Father himself will depart for his special Alpine summer retreat in Lorenzago di Cadore, where his predecessor, Pope John Paul II, spent six different summer breaks between 1987 and 1998. I'm Chris Altieri.
Assisi.
In his visit to Assisi, Pope Benedict will join with Franciscans worldwide as they celebrate the conversion of the little poor man from Assisi, from a pampered youth to one of the world's greatest saints.
That flow to the sea.
He was an Umbrian, he was an Italian, and he was born in one of the most beautiful spots in Italy. And it's true, the fields, the poppies, the sunflowers, it being a hill town, a beautiful little hill town, all of this would have influenced him. It's on the side of Mount Subasio, so his love of nature was there.
When you wander around Assisi, in the fields and in the hills, it's very easy to understand how Francis could have been bursting with joy on so many occasions because you hear the birds. There's a beautiful quality of the light. There are so many wild flowers around.
Yes, I'm at a loss to think of other traditions within the church that emphasize joy to this degree. Francis, in his own writings, speaks of it as a positive spiritual practice that keeps the devil away. That if the heart is filled with joy, there's no room for the spirit of darkness to enter.
Assisi, you'll always be home to me. You're part of my destiny, and I'm part of you.
There can be few Franciscans in the English-speaking world who are as well qualified to speak about St. Francis of Assisi as the brothers Bill Short and Murray Bodo. Brother Bill Short is one of the three co-editors of a massive volume of Franciscan writings known as the Compendium of Sources. It is the reference book for Franciscans throughout the world. Brother Murray Bodo, who has been leading Franciscan study pilgrimages to Assisi for more than 30 years, wrote a small booklet about Francis entitled The Journey and the Dream, a book that has inspired untold thousands of people across the world since its publication in 1972. I asked Father Murray what he understood as the journey of Francis.
The journey itself was the journey that he took from being a young man who wanted to be a knight and a troubadour, who took this journey from being a boy who was a part of the merchant class, moving in to being a knight, which was not the merchant class at the time, but his father had the money to outfit him and buy his way into being a knight. That journey, which he thought was going to be the journey of his life, because he was so taken with the tales of Charlemagne and his paladins, with Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, all of this sort of thing, this quest, this idea of the romance. From that journey to be turned around completely by God, leaving that whole military world, the whole world of ambition, to go not up this great mountain, this ascent into being a great and powerful personage in this world, but to move down into the plain below Assisi and live with the lepers and find there the real romance, the real journey. And we know that's true because towards the end of his life, when he wrote his testament, he said, "When I was in sin, it seemed to me a bitter thing to see lepers. And then the Lord himself led me among them, and what before was repugnant to me was turned into sweetness of soul for me." It's that journey, the journey from power to powerlessness, the journey from wanting to ascend to greatness to the journey of descending among the poor and the rejected and the marginal.
You'll always be home. You're part of my destiny, and I'm part of you.
Father Bill adds his own insight into the young Francis, a person who was so different from the saint of later days.
Francis's military training was sufficient to allow him to go to war with the Commune of Assisi in his youth. It was probably enough for him also to be carrying a sword in case of insult or injury. Well, we have beautiful stories from companions of his who must have grown up with him in Assisi and who gave testimony about his life after his canonization. And he appears there as the leader of what we would call a kind of social club in Assisi, presumably others of the merchant class who organized parties. Francis himself was known as quite an organizer of parties. And they're pictured as strutting about the city of Assisi as if in Babylon, which of course is supposed to give the reader the impression this was not a very pious group of young people wandering around.
Francis was quite possibly like any of the young Italians of today, spontaneous, joyful, expressive, and gregarious. He was probably often seen enjoying himself, and perhaps noisy in his festivities, but completely harmless and doing no evil. Yet Francis found his life turned upside down. He fell in love.
We certainly have evidence that he was interested in a kind of marriage that his friends couldn't understand, and it actually marks the beginning of his conversion. He would go about rather dreamy-eyed, and people would ask him if he was planning to marry, and he would give a very cryptic response that he had found a bride who was more lovely and wealthier than any that they might have known. By that time, he was already considering his marriage to Lady Poverty.
And Lady Poverty was one of the main guiding principles of Francis's whole reason for living.
Yes, we might say that she is the lady that this knight is going to serve. So Francis still has this figure in his imagination of being a knight, but now he's turned the ideal of knighthood upside down. And the lady that he will serve represents the poverty of Christ in the Incarnation. This mystery that captivated Francis made Christmas such an important feast for him, and it was very theologically important to see poverty as one of the aspects of God's love.
You'll always be home to me. You're part of my destiny. And I'm part of you.
So the dream then was to somehow be as close to Jesus Christ as possible. He was in love with Christ his whole life. Because Christ was poor, he wanted to be poor. Because of the Incarnation, everything that is human has been made holy by the Incarnation of Christ, and all of creation has been. And so Francis's dream is to somehow make Christ loved. He who he felt was not loved enough, that this Christ could be made known. The human Christ, the Christ who walked among us, the Christ who was also the Son of God, that this person would be a strong image in people's minds. And of course, Francis himself then becomes the icon of Christ in the Middle Ages, even to the extent of having the stigmata, the wounds of Christ. But he became like Christ for his time, the mirror of Christ, he was called.
As you see, I love your rolling fields, your flowers and silver streams that flow to the sea. As you see, part of my destiny.
Finally, we hear from Father James Caulfield, who, as a chaplain to the Royal Air Force, recently returned to England from Iraq and has a special outreach to the skies. I grew up hearing about my Uncle Frank, killed in action with the Royal Air Force at the age of 19. He has always been the family hero, his war medals shown with love, honour, respect and great pride. It was, therefore, with a sense of kinship that I spoke to Father James Caulfield, a chaplain to the Royal Air Force and recently returned from Iraq. I asked him about the role of a military chaplain in a situation in which people are risking their lives.
As chaplain, my role is there as a support to them in the same way as any priest is there to support his people. Obviously, our circumstances are a little different to most parishes, but you do need to be alongside the guys. It's no good sort of sending them off to war and saying, right, we can look after you when you come home. It's to be there in the thick of it when they need us most, providing support in the sacraments and prayer, and when necessary, you know, providing some moral guidance where needed.
But with, say, a naval chaplain, the chaplain is on the ship with his men. But as an RAF chaplain, you're not actually in the plane with them.
I have been, but not in the fighters, obviously, because there's no room. But I have been on board the larger aircraft at times when we've been on operations in the Balkans and indeed when we were flying over Iraq in some of the aircraft. So we do get aboard from time to time. And we also have the air bases themselves in Iraq, which are defended. And again, you have troops on the ground, RAF regiment personnel who are protecting those bases, which again need our support. So we are fairly close to the front line. In fact, I would argue slightly closer sometimes than the Navy.
Well, yes, because there must be a sort of sense of loneliness almost of a crew going into the plane, because at least when you've got a ship, you've got a large number of colleagues around, but in a plane you haven't got too many.
No, and depending on the aircraft, it could be just yourself or you could have maybe 10 or 14 people, but usually it's just a few, and it's a very select crew. You know, they stick together both in the air and on the ground. They support each other, which is why when we have, for example, a tragic loss of an aircraft like the Nimrod in an accident over Afghanistan, the impact of that is devastating, because they're such a close-knit crew with their families that everybody knows and is affected by it.
But, because their lives depend on each other.
Yes, yes.
It's both. Like the fire brigade, really, isn't it?
That's right. And the air crew's lives depend on the ground crew. There is a symbiosis there that they support each other. And the chaplain's role is very much a ground role, but it is part of that support network.
And presumably you'd have a different situation in helping the men when, for instance, you've got, say, a fighter or you've got a helicopter that's just carrying supplies, and then you've got troop carriers, and then you've got different situations that they're all going to be meeting.
Well, yes and no. I mean, the fighters fairly clear cut in the sense that they're usually their enemies fairly clearly defined, and that somebody is shooting at them and they're shooting back. It's fairly straightforward for them. For the helicopter pilots, they're often going in very dangerous territory and will, you know, have machine guns and things on board to protect themselves when they take those troops and supplies forward. So they are often much greater risk than the fighter pilots. And again, with the Hercules that are on my neighbouring base that I also look after, they're often going well advanced into forward areas at great peril to themselves to deliver troops and supplies. And the risk of that, you know, is something they balance every day, but it's something they, you know, they value. They know that they're needed and they go on and do it.
Well, when I spoke to you the other day, you said, I thought it was very beautiful, about the role of the chaplain being to keep your people human.
Yes. I think that in the sort of way of which warfare is and the sort of way in which you operate, it can be very easy to get sucked into the sort of we're here to some avenging cause or revenge or whatever and lose sight of the humanity and to the fact that, you know, we're not there to sort of be the sort of the master race or some great redeemer. We are there to help and to supply support to people and to remain human ourselves, even when at times, that's very difficult because you've seen your friends shot at, you've seen people killed, and it's very easy then to sort of, what's the phrase, to get the red mist and to lose your cool and go forward all guns blazing. To stay calm in those situations and to try and, you know, remain composed, a human, and do your duty is difficult. And again, a priest can sometimes help to just take that mist away, to help calm people, to help focus people back on the true humanity and cause of what we're trying to achieve.
And you're going to be coming up with every day not only the conflict between the Shia and the Sunni, but also you're going to be finding Iraqi Christians who are in a very vulnerable position.
Yes, you do. I mean, I had limited contact with the Iraqi citizenship in the sort of city of Basra. But yes, they are vulnerable. But again, it's part of the process of trying to reconstruct Iraq, is putting the democracy and the mechanisms into place that will enable all those people to live together. If we were to pull out of Basra at the moment, for example, I think that the Christian community might as well pack its bags, because the Shia population is so strong that they would not survive. And it's trying to balance that up in what is a very messy situation. But again, we have to be very careful that we don't start going down the track of saying this is some sort of religious crusade, because it isn't. It is very much about the economic and diplomatic and social reconstruction of Iraq, so that all peoples, regardless of faith, can come together and work together in a better way, and that we can reestablish a more distant relationship in terms of our, you know, we don't actually have to be on the ground, but nonetheless affable, with Iraq standing on its own two feet. And same in Afghanistan, where probably the main focus of our effort will be increasingly, where again we're trying desperately to re-establish a form of government in Iraq, in Afghanistan, that enables people to live together under a reasonable democratic system.
So really it's a very important part of your role to keep hope alive in a situation that is often personally tragic.
Yes, that's very well phrased, to keeping the hope alive. It is very difficult. I mean, none of us are oblivious to the sort of the moral arguments that are going on and the difficult political arguments about whys and wherefores of being in the locations we are in. But at times we have to trust that there are those that know more, and we have to, you know, build with hope that there is a better way forward, and that, you know, our presence is making a very profound difference. And there is evidence for that. I mean, we, you know, for example, in, again, Iraq, which I sort of have better knowledge of, having been there, there are bases which we're handing back. There is increased involvement by Iraqis in their own security and their own self-government and their own economic progress. You know, they are getting things back slowly but surely, and it is a slow process. And again, we're in a 24-hour media world that wants instant stories, and that's not going to happen. It is going to be a slow process. And again, sometimes as a priest, we have to try and remind people that, you know, it is about building something solid rather than a quick shoddy thing, and that will take time, and holding patience and hope in that is difficult.
But because you are in a war situation, you must have seen some incredible evidence of God working.
How you express that, I don't know. But certainly there are times when you see just little things. It's not big things. It's the little things of people supporting each other that actually suggest that God is at work. For example, the barber that I used to go to in Basra City was an Iraqi Christian and had his little pictures of a Madonna and things around. And he was entirely grateful to us for being there, and the joy that he had and was able to go to church and do things, and the hope rebuilding. But the sort of the wonder by when I told the other soldiers there that this guy was a Christian, they thought, oh, well, we don't have any Christians here. And he said, well, actually, we do. And that Christianity has been here a long time. And people then sort of realizing that, oh, yeah, actually, they sort of get a bit of an understanding of things. But it's not sort of big miracles. It's just quiet little things that show that maybe, yes, God is here, quietly working away in the work that's done by doctors, by the guys on the gate, you know, that all the time, the little moments where you sort of think, yeah, God is at work. I mean, in my own case, I retailed a story of a young lad that came for communion, dashing in. I'd actually packed up from Mass that it was over, but I happened to have communion with me because I was going on elsewhere to the med center. And we said a few short prayers and off he went. But there was a very precious moment in the height of all sort of confusion, when a young man came for the sacraments, and there I was, and you were able to help.
It must have put a whole different meaning on your whole priesthood.
I don't know that it has, to be honest, because I'm one of those oddballs. I'd grown up with the military, and so the military chaplaincy was always something I was considering. And, you know, you don't come into that world of being a military chaplain without giving some thought to the realities of war and, you know, to have read into it and background of it. But there are certainly times when it makes one feel grateful that you did make that choice, that, you know, it affirms the choice, the vocation to the military chaplaincy and to the priesthood in general.
Because the military chaplaincy is a vocation in itself.
Oh, yes, without a doubt. And I would encourage others to consider it. We very much need priests in the front line and also in the rear echelons. Wherever there are military personnel, the peculiarities of the life in the military, both be it out on the front line or with the families at home, where, again, we were greatly involved, in, particularly in the Air Force. We have a lot of involvement with families. In fact, I'm going from here to a meeting about the support we give to families. And, you know, priesthood has a very important role to play in that. A lot of soldiers and airmen will not profess a faith openly. But when you sit quietly alongside them in the pub or wherever, it's amazing that actually they might not use the same language as you or I to express it, but they do have a deep faith and a great belief in the morality of this world. And that's one of the strengths, that, you know, they're not sort of going out there killing or wicking, you know, they're not bashing things for the fun of it. They are actually there for a purpose and they know it. And there are times when morale is low, the equipment we've got is not particularly brilliant, the hours they work are very long, they get tired, they're separated from families for long periods of time, with communication sometimes disrupted and difficult. But nonetheless, somehow they hold it together. And in our small way as priests, we try and help them to do that and support the families as well.
And what's the difference between your role with the men out on the front line and back at home?
The only real difference is that we're sort of sharing the same risk. You know, in fact, in some ways, I'm at slightly greater risk because I don't have a weapon to defend myself with. I'm very dependent on them to do that for me. But basically, the role is the same. Primarily, you're there as a listening ear to give support and to provide the prayer and the sacrament. Back home, the provision of the sacrament isn't perhaps as critical because there's usually a parish church fairly close by in England, so they can go to Mass in the local village if they want to. But nonetheless, I think since I joined the military, I've probably heard far more true confessions in the sacrament of reconciliation than I've probably ever heard in the parish. Because that's the one sacrament I think shines through, the number of times when people genuinely want to try and unburden themselves. And for that, whether we're at home or overseas, it's about being alongside them, giving them the opportunity to get to know you, get to win your trust and confidence, and then slowly but surely they'll come forward. And in a stumbling conversation, you suddenly realise, ah, this is a guy's confession. And again, the language they use might not be the sort of the strict by the catechism definition of a confession, but that's what they're doing. And sometimes you can actually twist it round in their sort of speak and sort of say, well, you know, let's go for broke and we will go for the full reconciliation and absolution. And it's amazing the effect that can have on some. You know, it is a wonderful sacrament, but probably is the most used tool in my arsenal as a priest within the military.
Yes, I recently did an interview with an American priest who was ordained for both the Eastern and the Latin rites, and his understanding of the Sacrament of Reconciliation after 40 years as a military chaplain was absolutely incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, as I say, we talk about the shortage of clergy in the military and the sort of the shortage of priests particularly. So they are looking at increasingly trying to look at lay chaplaincy and diaconate and things. And that's fine in the home market back in England where, as I say, people can go to the local parish. But you can't replace the priest when it comes to the sacrament of reconciliation.
So we come to the end of our programme for today. You can hear it all again in whole or in its parts if you go to our website at www.vaticanradio.org/English. I am Sister Janet Ferns. Until we meet again, may God bless you.
This is the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.